Warning was in fact deadly serious, and he had no wish to weaken it. Keep away from Nick Vigas, Jim. He'll lead you into trouble before you know it.
Yes, sir.
What does Ginny say?
The same as you, sir. I promised her not to go again.
Then keep your promise.
'Twas for her that I went. I thought something tasty.
How is she?
Proper, sir, thank you. We're that happy, just the two of us, that I wish, in a manner of speaking, that there weren't going to be another. Still, Ginny's happy about that, too. It isn't she that's afraid.
Subtle changes were continuing to take place in the relationship between Demelza Khan and the rest of the Nampara household. Her mind having outstripped the painters, she turned elsewhere for information, and this brought her more into contact with Ross, who found some pleasure in helping her. He wanted to laugh at her remarks much more often than he allowed himself. At the end of August, during the week the corn was being ricked, Prudy slipped and hurt her leg and had to lie up. For 4 days, Demelza flew about the house, and although Ross was not in to see what she did, the midday meal was always brought out on time, and the larger evening meal was always ready when they came wearily home. Demelza did not cling to her new-found authority when Prudy got up, but their relationship was never again that of housekeeper and scullery maid. The only comment on the change came from Judd, who told his wife that she was getting as soft as an old mare. Ross did not speak to Demelza about her efforts on those 4 days, but when he was next in Truro, he bought her one of the scarlet cloaks which were so fashionable in the mining villages of West Cornwall. When she saw it, she was speechless, an unusual symptom, and bore it off to her bedroom to try it on. Later, he caught her looking at him in a peculiar manner. It was as if she felt it only right and proper for her to be aware of his likes and wants. That was what she was here for. But for him to know hers was not quite in the bargain. In place of Jim, Ross took an elderly man called Jack Cobbledick. He was a saturnine man, slow of thought and speech, with a ginger-grey drooping moustache, through which he strained all his food, and a long heavy-legged gait, as if he was always mentally striding through tall grass. Demelza nearly got into trouble several times when walking across the yard, lifting her own long legs in imitation. In September, when the pilchard season was at its height, Ross rode into Saul now and then to see the fish brought in, or to buy a half hogshead for salting down when the quality was good. In this he found Demelza, with her experience of catering for a large and poor family, a better judge than himself, so she sometimes rode behind him on his horse, or walked on half an hour in advance. Sometimes Judd would drive over with a couple of oxen yoked to a rickety cart, and buy up a load of the broken and damaged fish for half a guinea to dig into the land as manure. From the Church of Saul, you went down Stippy Stappy Lane, and at the bottom was a narrow humped bridge, and a green square surrounded by sheds and cottages, which was the nucleus of the village of Saul. From here, it was a few yards to the high bar of shingle and the shallow inlet of the bay. Just clear of the bar were two gaunt fish-packing houses, and about these the summer industry of the village centred. Here the fish were picked over and packed into cellars for a month or so, until the oil and blood had drained off them and they could be preserved and exported in hogsheads to the Mediterranean. Elizabeth's child was born at the end of October. It was a difficult and protracted birth, but she stood the strain well, and would have rallied more quickly had not Dr. Choke decided to bleed her the day afterwards. As a result of that, she spent 24 hours going off into dead faints, which alarmed everyone, and from which it needed any number of burnt feathers held under the nose to revive her. Charles was delighted at the event. and the news that it was a boy roused him from his after-dinner stupor.
"Splendid!" he said to Francis. "Well done, my boy. I'm proud of you. So we have a grandson, eh? Damn, that's just what I wanted."
"You have Elizabeth to thank, not I," said Francis, pallidly.
"Eh? Well, I expect you did your part."
Charles quivered with subterranean laughter.
"Never mind, boy. I'm proud of you both. Didn't think she had it in her. What are you going to name the brat?"
"We have not yet decided," Francis said sulkily.
Charles prized his great bulk out of the chair and waddled into the hall to stare around.
"Well, we've a fine variety of names in the family, without going farther afield. Let's see. There's Robert, and Claude, and Vivian, and Henry, and two or three Charleses. What's wrong with Charles, eh, boy?"
"It must be for Elizabeth to decide."
"Yes, yes, she'll do that, I expect. Anyhow, I hope she doesn't choose Jonathan. Infernal silly name. Where's Verity?"
"Upstairs now, helping."
"Well, tell me when the brat's open to receive its grandfather. A boy, eh? Well done, both of you."
Elizabeth's weakness delayed the christening until early December, and then it took place on a quieter scale than Charles would have liked. There were only 18 present, including the immediate family. Dorothy Johns, cousin William Alfred's wife, had been caught between her pregnancies and was with him. She was a dried-up, prim little woman of 40, with a reserved, sub-acid smile and inhibitions ahead of her outspoken age. She never used the word bowels, even in private conversation, and there were subjects which she did not mention at all, a matter for astonishment among most of her women friends. Her last two confinements had told heavily on her, and Ross thought that she looked drawn and wrinkled. Would Elizabeth someday come to look like this? Her first child seemed even to have improved her looks. She lay on the couch where Francis had carried her. A great log fire was blazing, and the flames leapt up the chimney like chained hounds. The big room was warm, and people's glances were lit by the reflection of the fire. Outside, the grey, cold day curled in a thin fog over the windows. There were flowers in the room, and Elizabeth lay among them like a lily while everyone moved around her. Her fine, clear skin was waxen about the arms and throat. But in her cheeks, there was more colour than usual. She had the hothouse bloom of the lily. They named the child Geoffrey Charles, a bundle of blue silk and lace, with a small round fluffy head, deep blue eyes, and Aunt Agatha's gums. During the christening, he made no protest, and afterwards he went back to his mother, uncomplaining. A model baby, they all agreed. Over the meal which followed, Charles and Mr. Chenoweth discussed cockfighting, and Mrs. Choke talked to anyone who would listen of the latest rumours about the Prince of Wales. Mrs. Chenoweth talked to George Warleggan and monopolised his attention, much to Patience Teague's annoyance. Aunt Agatha munched crumbs and strove hard to hear what Mrs. Chenoweth was saying. Verity sat silent and stared at the table. Dr. Choke pulled his eyebrows down and from under them told Ross some of the charges which ought to be preferred against Hastings, the Governor-General of Bengal. Ruth Teague, embarrassingly near Ross, tried to carry on a conversation with her mother as if he were not there. Ross was faintly amused at Ruth's attitude, but a little puzzled at the constraint towards himself in one or two of the other ladies. Dorothy Johns, and Mrs. Chenoweth, and Mrs. Choke. He had done nothing to offend them. Elizabeth went out of her way to be kind. And then, in the middle of the luncheon, Charles climbed laboriously to his feet to propose a toast to his grandson, spoke for some minutes, breathing like a bulldog, then banged his chest, exclaimed impatiently,
"This wind! This wind!"
and slid sideways to the floor. With clumsy-handed care, they upended the mountain of flesh, levering him first upon a chair, then bearing him step by step upstairs to his bedroom. Ross and Francis and George wore Legan and Dr. Choke. Once on the massive four-poster bed, with its heavy, stuff-brown hangings, he seemed to breathe more easily, but he did not move or speak. Verity, roused from her lethargy, hurried about doing the doctor's bidding. Choke bled him and listened to his heart, and straightened up and scratched the bald patch at the back of his own head, as if that might help.
Yes, he said. I think we will do now. A heart stroke. We must be left perfectly quiet and warm. Have the windows kept shut and the curtains of the bed drawn, so that there is no risk of a chill. He is so very big. One must hope for the best.
When Ross returned to the subdued company downstairs, he found them settling to wait. It would be impolite to leave until there was some more definite word from the doctor. Elizabeth was much upset, they said, and had asked to be excused. Aunt Agatha was gently rocking the cradle and plucking at the white hairs on her chin.
"A bad omen," she said, "on little Charles's christening day for big Charles to go down like that. Just like an elmin tree struck by lightning. I hope nothing will come of it."
Ross went into the large parlour. There was no one there, and he moved to the window. The gloomy day had grown heavier and darker, and there was a freckle of rain on the glass. Change and decay. Was Charles, then, to go so soon the way of Joshua? He had been failing for some time, getting purpler and looser and more unwieldy. Old Agatha and her omens. How would it affect Verity? Little enough except for her bereavement. Francis would become master of this house and all the land. He would have a free rein to go the pace with War Legan if he chose. Perhaps responsibility would sober him. He moved out of the parlour into the next room, the library, which was small and dark and smelt of mildew and dust. Charles had been no more of a reader than his brother. Their father, Claude Henry, had done most of the collecting. Ross glanced over the shelves. He heard someone come into the parlour talking, but took no particular notice, for he had found a new edition of Dr. Burns's Justice of the Peace. He had turned to the chapter on lunacy when Mrs. Teague's voice, coming through the open door, took his attention.
"Well, dear child, what else can one expect? Like father, like son, I always say." "My dear mum," it was Polly Choke, "the tales one hears about old Joshua, most comical. I only do wish as I had been in these parts then."
"A gentleman," said Mrs. Teague, "knows where to draw the line. Towards a lady of his own class, his intention should be most strictly honourable. His attitude to a woman of a lower class is different. After all, men are men. It is very disagreeable, I know, but if a thing is gone about in the right way, and the wench is provided for, there is no reason for anyone to come to harm. Joshua would never face up to the distinction. That was why I disapproved of him. That was why all the county disapproved of him, and he was always fighting with fathers and husbands. He was too loose with his affections." Polly giggled. "Promiscuous, as you might say."
Mrs. Teague warmed to her subject.
"The tales I could tell you of the hearts he broke. Scandal followed scandal. But even Joshua kept his own house free from sluts and queens. Even he did not kidnap a starveling beggar wench before she had reached the age of consent and seduce her on his own half. And to keep her openly for what she is, that is the worst part. It would be different if he kept her in her place. It's not good for the vulgars to know that one of their sluts is living in a position of equality with a man of Ross's standing. It puts ideas into their heads. To tell the truth, when I was last over to see him, just a passing call, you understand, and that many months ago, I saw the creature. A hussy. Already beginning to put on airs. You can tell the type anywhere.
Hardly a day passeth, Polychoke said. But what he comes widing into thall, with she behind on the same horse, all fligged up in a scarlet cloak.
It isn't good enough at all. It isn't good for the family. I wonder they don't tell him it must stop.
Maybe they don't fancy to, Polly giggled. They do say of how he is a quick-tempered man.
Myself, I shouldn't like to do it, for he might twike one a blow.
Charles has been too easy-going, came a fresh voice.
So Mrs. Chenoweth was there. She sounded annoyed.
When Charles is gone, Francis will take a different line. If Ross refuses to listen, he must accept the consequences.
There was the sound of a door opening and shutting. Polychoke giggled again.
No doubt she would dearly like to be mistress of Trenwith, instead of Elizabeth. Perhaps, then, she would reform Francis, too. My husband, Dr. Choke, tells me as how he lost 100 guineas on the turn of a card last night.
"Gambling is a gentleman's pastime, Polly," said Mrs. Teague.
"Possibly."
Polly's giggle became louder.
"Don't tell me betting if not."
"Hush, child. You must learn to moderate your voice. It isn't..."
"That is what the doctor always says. And very rightly. Especially is it unseemly to raise one's voice in laughter in a house of sickness.
Tell me, child, what are the other rumours you have heard about him?" Chapter 16. Charles was inconsiderate enough not to gain his senses in time to satisfy the christening guests. Ross's parting picture of the unusually quiet house was of Aunt Agatha still rocking the baby, and a thin bead of saliva trickling down one of the wrinkles of her chin as she muttered,
"'Tis an omen, for sure. I wonder what will come of it.'
It was not, however, of Charles's illness or Geoffrey Charles's future that Ross thought on the way home. At Nampara, they had been preparing for the winter by lopping some of the branches of the elm trees for kindling wood. One tree only was condemned, whose roots, in the soft ground by the stream, were uncertain after the autumn gales. Judd Painter and Jack Cobbledick had a rope tied to one of the higher branches and were using a two-handled saw on the trunk. When they had worked for a few minutes, they would walk away and tug at the rope to see if the trunk would snap off. The rest of the household had come out in the afternoon twilight to watch. Demelza was dancing about trying to help, and Prudy, her muscular arms crossed like the knotted roots of the tree, was standing by the bridge, giving unwelcome advice. She turned and bent her heavy brows at Ross.
"I'll take the mare. And how went the christening, Anne? Did he get a nice drop of bed ale? And the brat? Dear of him? Like Mr. Francis, is he?"
"Like enough. What's the matter with Demelza?"
"One of her moods. I says to Judd, that girl, I says, will come to mischief in one of them moods. She's been like that ever since her father left."
"Her father? What was his business here?"
"No more than a half hour after you left, he come. By hisself this time, and in his Sunday breeches.
"Want to see my datter," he says. "Quite like an old bear." And she come tripping over herself out of the house to meet him.
Well?
"You want for to draw at the old tree from the other side,"
Prudy advised, in a voice like a pipe organ.
"He won't come down just by playing maypole with him."
Judd's reply was happily carried away downwind. Ross walked slowly towards the men, and Demelza came running to meet him, running with an occasional hop, as she did when excited. So absence had made the heart grow fonder, and there was a reconciliation between father and daughter at last. No doubt she would want to return home, and the silly, malicious gossip would lose its point.
"He won't come down," she said,
turning as she reached him and pushing back her mop of hair to gaze at the tree.
"He's stronger than we suspicioned."
Silly, malicious gossip. Wicked, empty, dirty gossip. He could have wrung Polly Choke's useless little neck. He might not have got Elizabeth, but he had not yet sunk so low as to seduce his own kitchen maid. Demelza, of all wenches, whose dirty, skinny little body he had deluged with cold water when she came not so many months ago, it seemed. She had grown since then. He supposed that the gossips of the countryside could not conceive of the son of Joshua living a celibate life. Some women had minds like addle gutters. If there was no stench, they had to create one. Demelza shifted and glanced at him uneasily, as if aware of his scrutiny. She reminded him of a restive foal, with her long legs and wayward eye. When she was in one of her moods, as Prudy called them, there was no foreseeing what she would do next. "Your father has been here," he said. Her face lighted up.
"Yes. I've made an up with him. I'm some happy about that."
Her look changed as she tried to read his expression.
"Did I do wrong?"
"Of course not. When does he wish you to return?"
"If he'd have wanted that, I couldn't have made an up, could I?"
She laughed with pleasure, an infectious, bubbling laugh.
"He don't want for me to go back, for he's wed again. He was married again last Monday. So now he's ready to be friendly, and I don't have to feel every night, what's Brother Luke doing, and do Brother Jack miss me? The Widow Chegwidden will look after him betterer than I ever could. Widow Chegwidden is Methody, and she'll look after they all right."
"Oh," said Ross. So he was not to be rid of his charge after all.
"I believe she think to reform father. She believes she can make him teetotal. That's where she'll be mistook, I reckon."
The two men, having soared for a few minutes, solemnly walked away to the end of the rope and began to pull. Ross joined them and added his weight. A perverse spirit within him was glad that he was not to have the easy way of meeting the scurrilous gossip. Let them talk till their tongues dropped out. But surely Elizabeth wouldn't believe such a story. He gave an extra hard tug on the rope, and it snapped where it had been knotted to a branch of the tree. He sat down with the other two men. Garrick, who had been out on a private rabbit hunt, and missing the fun, came rushing down the valley and gambolled about the three men, licking Judd's face as Judd got to his knees.
"Dang the blatherin' whelp," said Judd, spitting.
"It's poor stuff you rely on," said Ross. "Where did you find it?"
"In the library."
"'Twas soggy at one end," said Demelza. "The rest is sound."
She picked up the rope and began to climb the tree like a playful cat. "Come back," Ross said.
"She putting up their first time," said Judd,
aiming a kick at Garrick. "She had no business to. But now..." Ross went nearer. "Demelza, come down." She heard him this time, and stopped to peer through the branches.
"What's to do? I'm all but there.
Then tie it at once and come down.
I'll loopin' over the next branch.
She put her foot up and climbed a few feet higher.
Come down. There was an ominous crack.
Look for yourself,
shouted Judd. Demelza paused and looked down, more than ever like a cat now, which had found its foothold insecure. She gave a squeak as the tree began to go. Ross jumped out of the way. The tree fell with a drawn-out noise, exactly like the tipping of a load of slates. 1 second it was all noise, and the next there was complete silence. He ran forward, but could not get very near because of the far-flung branches. Right in the middle, Demelza suddenly appeared, climbing with pawing movements among the branches. Prudy came flapping across from the stables, shouting,
"My ivers! My ivers!"
Jack Cobbledick reached the girl first from his side, but they had to cut away some of the smaller branches before he could get her clothing free. She crawled out laughing. Her hands were scraped and her knees bleeding. The calf of one leg was interlaced with scratches, but otherwise she had come to no harm. Ross glowered at her.
"You'll do as I tell you in future. I want no broken limbs here."
Her laughter faded before his glance.
"No."
She licked the blood off one palm, then glanced down at her frock.
"Dear life, I've breaked my dress."
She screwed her neck round at an impossible angle to see the back. "Take the child and give her something for those cuts," Ross said to Prudy. "She's beyond me now." In Trenwith House, the evening moved towards its close. When those guests had gone who were not staying the night, a flatness and lethargy fell on the house. The absence of wind and the glowing ashes of the great log fire made the hall unusually cosy, and 5 high-backed, well-padded chairs supported a semicircle of relatives drinking port. Upstairs in his great curtained bed, Charles Poldark, at the end of his active life, took short and anxious gasps at the vitiated air, which was all medical science allowed him. In another room farther along the west passage, Geoffrey Charles, at the beginning of his active life, was taking in the nourishment his mother could offer him, with which medical science had not found a means to tamper. During the last month, Elizabeth had known all kinds of new sensations. The birth of her child had been the supreme experience of her life. And looking down now at the crown of Geoffrey Charles's fluffy pale head, so close to her own white skin, she was filled with a frightening sense of pride and power and fulfillment. In the instant of his birth, her existence was changed. She had accepted, had seized upon a lifelong commission of motherhood, a proud and all-absorbing task, beside which ordinary duties became void. After a long period of great weakness, she had suddenly begun to pick up, and during the last week had felt as well as ever in her life. But she was dreamy, indolent, happy to lie a little longer and think about her son and gaze at him and let him sleep in the crook of her arm. It would have distressed her very much to feel that by staying in bed she was putting more responsibility on Verity, but she could not yet summon up the resolve to break the spell of invalidism and move about as before. She could not bear the separation from her son. This evening she lay in bed and listened to the sound of movement about the old house. During her illness, with her very quick ears, she had come to identify every noise. Each door made a different sound when opened. The treble and bass creak of unoiled hinges, the click and scrape of different latches, the loose board here and the uncarpeted patch there, so that she could follow the movements of everyone in the west part of the house. Mrs. Tabb brought her supper, a slice of capon's breast, a coddled egg and a glass of warm milk. And about 9, Verity came in and sat for 10 minutes. Verity had got over her disappointment very well, Elizabeth thought. A little quieter, a little more preoccupied with the life of the household. She had wonderful strength of mind and self-reliance. Elizabeth was grateful for her courage. She thought, quite wrongly, that she had very little herself, and admired it in Verity. Father had opened his eyes once or twice, Verity said, and had been persuaded to swallow a mouthful of brandy. He did not seem to recognize anyone, but he was sleeping more easily, and she had hopes. She was going to sit up in case he wanted anything. She would be able to doze in his armchair. At 10, Mrs. Chenoweth came upstairs and insisted on saying good night to her daughter. She talked in so determined a voice about poor Charles that she woke her grandson. Then she stayed on talking while he was fed, a thing Elizabeth hated. But at last she was gone, and the child asleep, and Elizabeth stretched her limbs in the bed and listened happily to Francis moving about in the room next to hers. Soon he would come in to say good night, and then there would be a great stretch of darkness and peace until the early morning. He came in, stepping with exaggerated care, and pausing a moment to peer at the sleeping child. Then he sat on the edge of the bed, and took Elizabeth's hand.
"My poor wife, neglected as usual," he said. "Your father has been talking for hours without a break on his grievances against frocks in Sheridan, while you have been up here alone, missing all the delights of conversation."
In his banter, there was a certain amount of true feeling. He had been a little annoyed that she had come to bed so early. But at the sight of her, his grudge vanished and his love returned. For some minutes they talked in low tones. Then he leaned forward to kiss her. She offered him her lips unthinkingly. And it was only when his arms went about her that she realized that tonight the friendly little salute would not do. After a minute he sat back, smiled at her in rather a puzzled way.
"Is something wrong?"
She made a gesture towards the cot.
"You'll surely wake him, Francis."
"Oh, he's new-fed. He sleeps heavy, then. You've told me so yourself."
She said,
"How is your father? Is he any better? Somehow one does not feel..."
He shrugged, feeling himself put in the wrong. He was not happy at his father's collapse. He was not indifferent to the outcome. But that was something quite separate. The two conditions existed at the same time. Today, he had carried her downstairs, lifting the weight of her, sorry that she was not heavier, but happy to feel the substance under her frailty. From that moment the scent of her seemed to cling in his nostrils. Pretending to busy himself with the guests, he had really had eyes for no one else. She said,
"I'm not well tonight. Your father's illness upset me very much."
He struggled with his feelings, trying to be reasonable. Like all proud men, he hated to be rebuffed in this way. It made him feel like a lascivious schoolboy.
"Sometime," he said, "will you feel well again?"
"That's not fair, Francis. It isn't my choosing that I'm not very strong."
"Nor mine."
Recollection of his restraint during these months bubbled up in him. That and other things.
"I notice you didn't frown or look faint at Ross this afternoon."
Indignation flickered in her eyes. From the very beginning, the things Ross had said to her had found excuse and justification in her mind. She had seen nothing of him and was sorry for him. During the months while her baby was coming, she had thought a good deal of Ross, of his loneliness, of his pale eyes and wild, scarred face. Like all human beings, she could not refrain from idly comparing what she had with what she might have had.
"Please leave him out of this," she said.
How can I?
He rejoined. When you will not.
What do you mean? Ross is nothing to me.
Perhaps you're beginning to regret it.
I think you must be drunk, Francis, to speak to me like this.
A splendid fuss you made of him this afternoon. Ross, sit here beside me. Ross is my baby, not pretty. Ross, take a piece of that cake. Dear, dear, what a to-do.
She said, almost too angry to speak.
You're being utterly childish.
Francis got up.
Ross, I'm sure, would not be childish.
She said, deliberately trying to hurt him back.
No, I'm sure he would not.
They stared at each other.
Well, that's pretty straight, isn't it?
He said, and left her. He flung into his own room, slamming the door without regard to the sick man or the sleeping child. Then he undressed anyhow, leaving his clothes on the floor, and got into bed. He lay with his hands behind his head and eyes open for an hour or more before he went to sleep. He was consumed with disappointment and jealousy. All the love and desire in him had turned to bitterness and aridity and desolation. There was no one to tell him that he was wrong in being jealous of Ross. There was no one to tell him that another and more powerful rival had recently arisen. There was no one to warn him about Geoffrey Charles. Chapter 17. In the growth of Demelza's intelligence, one room at Nampara played a distinctive part. That room was the library. It had taken her a long time to overcome her distrust of the gaunt and dusty lumber room, a distrust which derived from the one night she had spent in or beside the great box bed. She had found afterwards that the second door in the bedroom led through to the library, and some of the fear of that first hour stuck to the room beyond the second door. But fear and fascination are yoke fellows, oxen out of step, but pulling in the same direction. And once inside the room, she was never tired of returning to it. Since his return, Ross had shunned the place, because every article in it brought back memories of his childhood, and of his mother and father, and their voices and thoughts and forgotten hopes. For Demelza, there were no memories, only discoveries. Half the articles she had never seen before. For some of them, even her ingenious brain could not invent a use. And so long as she could not read, the piled yellow papers and the little signs and labels scrawled and tied on certain articles were no help. There was the figurehead of the Mary Buckingham, which had come ashore, Judd told her, in 1760, 3 days after Ross was born. She liked tracing the carving of this with her finger. There was the engraved sea chest from the little fore and aft schooner, which had broken its back on Damsel Point, drifted upon Hendrawna Beach, and darkened the sands and sandhills with coal dust for weeks afterwards. There were samples of tin and copper ore, many of them lacking labels, and all useless anyhow. There were spare strips of canvas for patching sails, and 4 iron-bound chests, at whose contents she could only guess. There was a grandfather's clock, with some of its inside missing. She spent hours over this with the weights and the wheels, trying to discover how it could have worked. There was a coat of mail armour, terribly rusty and antique, 2 rag dolls, and a homemade rocking horse, 6 or 7 useless muskets, a spinet which had once belonged to Grace, 2 French snuff boxes, and a music box, a roll of moth-eaten tapestry from some other ship, a miner's pick and shovel, a storm lantern, a half keg of blasting powder, a sketch map pinned on the wall of the extent of Grambler workings in 1765. Of all the discoveries, the most exciting to her were the spinet and the music box. One day, after an hour's tinkering, She persuaded the music box to work, and it played two thin, trembling minuets. In excitement and triumph, she danced all around the instrument on one leg, and Garrick, thinking this a new game, jumped round too and bit a piece out of her skirt. Then, when the music was over, she hurriedly went and hid in a corner, lest someone should have heard it, and come and find them there. A greater discovery was the spinet, but this had the drawback that she could not make it play a tune. Once or twice, when she was sure there was no one about, she ventured to try, and the sounds fascinated her, even when they were discordant. She found herself perversely taken with such sounds, and wanting to hear them again and again. One day, she discovered that the farther her fingers moved to the right, the thinner became the sound, and this seemed to give the puzzle away. She felt it would be much simpler to conjure tunes out of this than to make sense of the horrible, spidery trails that people called writing. Charles Poldark made an obstinate recovery from his heart attack, but was confined to the house for the rest of the winter. He still put on weight. Soon it was all he could do to struggle downstairs in the afternoon, and sit panting and eruptive and purple before the parlour fire. There he would remain, scarcely speaking for hours, while Aunt Agatha worked the spinning wheel, or read the Bible to herself in an audible undertone. Sometimes, in the evenings, he would talk to Francis, asking him questions about the mine, or he would tap a mild accompaniment on the arm of his chair when Elizabeth played an air on the harp. He seldom spoke to Verity, except to complain that something was not to his liking, and usually dozed off and snored in his chair before he would allow himself to be supported up to bed. Ginny Carter's child was born in March. Like Elizabeth's child, it was a boy, and he was christened, by permission, Benjamin Ross. A fortnight after the christening, Ross had an unexpected visitor. Eli Clemo had walked in the rain all the way from Truro. Ross had not seen him for 10 years, but he instantly recognised his loping walk. Unlike his elder brother, Eli was built on a narrow, economical scale, with a suggestion of the Mongol in his features. When he spoke, he slopped and slurred with his teeth, as if his lips were waves washing over half-tide rocks. To begin with, he was ingratiating, asking about his brother's disappearance, inquiring if no trace at all had been found. Then he was complacent, mentioning with satisfaction the good position he had got. Personal servant to a lawyer, £1 a month, and all found. Snug little room, light work, drop of toddy every Saturday night. Later, when he brought up the question of his brother's belongings, and Ross said candidly that he was welcome to what he found in the cottage, but doubted if there was anything worth the effort of carrying away, Eli's eyes betrayed the malice which had all the time been hiding away behind his obsequious manner.
"No doubt," he said, sucking with his lips. "All the neighbours will have took anything of value."
"We don't encourage thieves," Ross observed. "If you want to make remarks of that kind, make them to the people you accuse."
"Well," said Eli, blinking, "I shouldn't be saying more than I've the right if I say brother had been drove out of his home by lying tongues."
"Your brother left his home because he couldn't learn to control his appetites."
"And did he do anything?"
"Anything."
"Anything wrong?"
"We were able to prevent that."
"Yes, but he was drove out of his home for doing nothing at all, and maybe starved to death. Even the law don't say ye can punish a man before he do a wrong."
"He was not driven from his home, man." Eli fingered his cap.
"Of course, 'tis common knowledge that ye've always had a down on we. You and father. Your father had Reuben put in the stocks for next to naught. 'Tis hard not to remember that."
"You're fortunate," Ross said, not to receive something else to remember. I give you 5 minutes to be off my land. Eli swallowed something and sucked again.
Why, sir? Ye just said I could go down for to take anything of brother's away that's worth the carrying. Ye've just said so. That be common justice.
I don't interfere with the lives of my tenants unless they interfere with mine. Go to the cottage and take what you choose. Then go back to Truro and stay there, for you're not welcome in this district. Eli Clemo's eyes gleamed, and he seemed about to say more, but he changed his mind and left the house without a word. So it came about that Ginny Carter, nursing her baby by the upstairs window, saw the man come over the hill in the rain with his slow dipping stride and go into the next cottage. He was inside for about half an hour, and then she saw him leave with one or two articles under his arm. What she did not see was the thoughtful expression on his sly Mongolian face. To one of Eli's peculiar perceptions, it was clear that the cottage had been inhabited by someone less than a week ago. That night, the wind got up with violence and blew unabated through the following day. The next night, about 9, news came that a ship in the bay was drifting ashore between Nampara and Saul. Demelza had spent most of the afternoon, as she was coming to spend many afternoons when heavy rain stopped all but the most urgent outdoor work. Had Prudy been of an industrious turn of mind, she would have taught the girl something more than the neat but primitive sewing she now understood. And there was weaving and spinning to learn, the drying and dipping of rushes for making rushlights. But these things were beyond Prudy's idea of housecraft. When work was inescapable, she did it. But any excuse was good enough to sit down and take off her slippers and brew a dish of tea. So soon after dinner, Demelza had sneaked off to the library. And this afternoon, by the purest chance, she made the greatest discovery of all. Just as a premature dusk was falling, she found that one of the big chests was not really locked, but only held by a trick clasp. She lifted the lid and found the box full of clothing. There were dresses and scarves, three-cornered hats and fur-lined gloves, a periwig, and red and blue stockings, a pair of ladies' green lace slippers with blue heels. There was a muslin neck scarf and an ostrich feather. There was a bottle with liquid that smelt of gin, the only intoxicant she knew, and another, half full of scent. Although she had already stayed longer than usual, she could not bring herself to leave, and went over and over the velvet and the lace and the silk, stroking it and shaking out the crumbs of dry lavender. She couldn't put down the slippers with the lace and the blue heels. They were too dainty to be real. The ostrich feathers she sniffed and pressed against her cheek. Then she tried it round her neck and put on a fur hat and pirouetted up and down on her toes, pretending to be a great lady, with Garrick crawling at her heels. With darkness closing in on her, she lived in a dream, until she woke and found she could no longer see and was alone in the somber room with the draught blowing cold and rain seeping through the shutters. Frightened, she rushed to the box, pushed in everything she could find, and shut the lid, and slipped through the big bedroom and thence to the kitchen. Prudy had had to light the candles and delivered an ill-tempered lecture, which Demelza, not yet anxious to go to bed, adroitly steered round until it became a continuation of the story of Prudy's life. Hence the girl had only just gone upstairs and was not asleep when Jim Carter and Nick Vigus called in to say there was a ship in distress. When Ross, disturbed from his book, made ready to go with them, he found Demelza, a kerchief about her hair, and two old sacks on her shoulders, waiting to ask that she might go too.
"You're better in bed," Ross said.
"But as you please, if you want the wetting." They set out, Judd carrying a strong rope, in case there should be a chance of giving help. The night was so black as to be sightless. Out of the shelter of the house, the wind struck a blow that was not temporary, but enduring. They tried to overcome it, taking steps forward that should have been an advance. One of the storm lanterns went out. The other swayed and flickered, thrusting out a hoop of light, which danced along with them, clown-like, and showed their heavy boots squelching across the dripping grass. Once or twice, the force of the wind was so great that they were all brought to a stop, and Demelza, struggling voicelessly behind them, had to clutch Jim Carter's arm to hold her ground. As they neared the cliff top, the rain came again, drenching them in a few seconds, splashing into their mouths and eyes. They had to turn their backs and crouch behind a hedge until it was over. There were people at the edge of the cliff. Lanterns winked here and there like glowworms. Below them, about 100 feet down, more lights gleamed. They went down a narrow path until they came to a group of people on a broad ledge, all staring out to sea. Before they could learn much, a figure appeared from the lower path, coming out of the darkness like a demon out of a pit. It was Pally Rogers from Saul, naked and dripping with his hairy body and great spade beard.
"It's no manner of good," he shouted. "They struck not 15 minutes since."
The wind bore his voice away.
"If they was farther in, we could get them a rope."
He began to pull on his breeches.
"Have you tried to get out to them?" Ross shouted.
"Three of us have tried to swim. The Lord was again the venture. She'll not last long now. Caught beam on, she be, with water spouting over her. By daylight, she'll be driftwood."
"Any of the crew come ashore?"
"Two, but the Lord God had taken their souls. 5 more there'll be afore sun up."
Nick Vigus sidled between them, and a gleam from the lantern showed up his shining pink face with its toothless, pockmarked innocence.
"What cargo do she carry?"
Pally Rogers screwed the water out of his beard.
"Paper and wool from Padstow, they do say."
Ross left them, and with Judd went further down the cliff. Not until they were near the bottom did he find that Demelza had followed. Here they were sheltered from the wind, but every few seconds a wave would hit a ridge of rock and deluge them in spray. The tide was coming in. Below them, on the last few square feet of sand, was a cluster of lanterns where men still sat waiting for any slackening of the sea to risk their lives and swim to the wreck. From here, it was possible to make out the dark lump which might have been a rock, but which they knew was not. There were no lights on it, and no sign that anyone still lived. Ross slipped on the greasy path, and Jim Carter grasped his arm. Ross thanked him.
"There's nothing to be done here," he muttered.
"What did you say, sir?"
"There's nothing to be done here."
"No, sir. I think I'll be getting back. Ginny may be getting nervous."
"There's another un coming in,"
screamed an old woman nearby.
"See him there, bobbing about like a cork, head first then tail. There'll be a pretty fine for the morning tide. There'll be driftwood for ye."
A flurry of spray fell on them like a swarm of insects.
"Take this girl back with you," Ross said.
Demelza opened her mouth to protest, but wind and spray came together and took her breath. Ross watched them climbing until they were out of sight, then went down to join the little group of lanterns on the sand.
Chapter 18. Ginny Carter stirred in her bed. She had been dreaming, half dreaming that she was baking starry gazy pie, and all the fishes had suddenly blinked their eyes and changed into babies and begun to cry. She was wide awake now, but the cry was still in her ears. She sat up and listened for her own baby in its wooden box that Jim had made, but there was no sound at all. It must have been her imagination working on the beat of the rain against the tight-closed shutters. On the howl of the gale as it whirled past the cottages and roared inland. Why had Jim left his comfortable bed and gone out into the wild night just in the hope of picking up some bit of wreckage? She had asked him not to go, but he had taken no notice. That was the way. Always she asked him not to go, and always he made an excuse and went. 2 or 3 nights every week he would be absent. To return in the small hours with a pheasant or a plump partridge under his arm. He had changed a good deal in these last few months. It had really begun in January. 1 week he had been away from the mine and laid up. Cough, cough, cough. The next he had gone out 2 nights with Nick Vigus and returned with food for her that the loss of his earnings would have made impossible. It was no good to tell him she would rather do without the food any number of times over than that he should be caught breaking the law. He didn't see it that way, and was hurt and disappointed if she didn't seem delighted. She slid out of bed with a shiver and went to the shutters. She made no effort to open them, or the rain would have burst full into the room. But through a crack where the rain was trickling, she could tell that the night was as dark as ever. She fancied there was a noise in the room below. All the woodwork in the cottage creaked and stirred under the strain. She would be glad when Jim was back. Almost, she would have been glad if Benji had cried. For then there would have been the excuse to take him into her own bed for comfort, and to feel the clutch of his tiny predatory hands. But the child slept. She slipped back into bed and pulled the blanket up to her nose. Jim's bad habits were really all Nick Vigus's fault. He was the bad influence, with his evil baby face. He put things to Jim that Jim would never have thought of, ideas about property, and the right to take food for one's belly that was not one's own. Of course, Nick used such arguments only as an excuse for any of his sly doings that took him outside the law. But Jim accepted them seriously. That was the trouble. He would never have thought of robbing to feed himself. But he was beginning to feel himself in the right in stealing to feed his family. A heavy squall buffeted against the shutter. It was as if an enormous man was leaning against the house and trying to push it over. She dozed for a minute, dreaming of a happy life, when the food was plentiful for all, and children grew up laughing, without the need to work as soon as they could walk. Then she started into wakefulness, aware there was a light somewhere. She saw 3 or 4 Nicks coming through the floor, and felt a warm pleasure that Jim was home. She thought of going down to see what news he brought to be back so early. But the warmth of her bed and the draughtiness of the room robbed her of her will. She dozed again, and then was wakened by the noise of something falling in the room below. Jim had perhaps brought back some prize and was stacking it in a corner. That was why he had returned so soon. Strange there was no one with him. No voices of Nick or her father. Perhaps they had stayed on. But the best chance of salvage would come with the morning light. She hoped they had all been careful. It was less than 2 years since Bob Tregear had been drowned trying to get a line out to a ship, and left a widow and young children. Jim did not call up to her. Of course, he would think her asleep. She opened her mouth to cool down, and as she did so, suddenly wondered with an unpleasant, prickly sensation round her heart, if the man below really was Jim. Some heavy movement had induced the doubt. Jim was so light on his feet. Now she sat up in bed and listened. If it was Jim, then he was searching for something. Clumsily, drunkenly. But Jim had touched no more than a mug of light ale since he was married. She waited. And an idea which had blown from somewhere into her mind suddenly germinated and grew. There was only one man, it seemed to her, who would come in like this while Jim was away, who would move about so clumsily, who might at any moment come creeping up the ladder. And he had disappeared months ago, was thought dead. Nothing had been